Okay, so we're going to continue our study, Visions of God, and in particular, we're going to look at a few places in Isaiah that aren't visions directly. It doesn't say this is a vision that I had or something like that. These are prophecies. Of course, the entire book of Isaiah is characterized in the very first verse as the vision of the prophet Isaiah, right? But the reason I wanted to take a look at these are in Isaiah 19, 21, and 34 is the language that's used and the imagery that's used, because we're going to see this later in other scriptures. And then, Lord willing, we will get into Ezekiel today. But we will see first. So first of all, let's go to Isaiah 19. Now, you remember, I have one correction to make to last week's lesson. When we were talking about Isaiah chapter 6, where he sees the seraphim, right? And, you know, the God on the throne and the robe filling the throne and all that kind of stuff we were talking about. I was asking, when was all this happening? And I said, who was king at the time? And I said, Hezekiah. Well, Hezekiah wasn't king then. Hezekiah was king later. Isaiah lived a long time, and he had several kings. In fact, they're all listed in the first verse. Amaziah, and let's just take a look. I want to get this right. Sometimes the memory doesn't serve. Verse 1, the vision of Isaiah, son of Amoz, which you saw concerning Judah and Jerusalem in the days of Uzziah, Jotham, Ahaz, and Hezekiah, kings of Judah. So, what I was talking about, though, was the general time period of Isaiah's prophecy, because Isaiah prophesied roughly 100 years before Jerusalem was taken and taken off to Babylon. So a lot of these, you know, we've got to keep in mind the time period of these prophecies that we're going to hear today. So we have, that's the wrong button here. 19 verse 1. The burden against Egypt. Behold, the Lord rides on a swift cloud and will come into Egypt. The idols of Egypt will totter at his presence, and the heart of Egypt will melt in its midst. I will set Egyptians against Egyptians, and everyone will fight against his brother, and everyone against his neighbor, city against city, kingdom against kingdom. The spirit of Egypt will fail in its midst. I will destroy their counsel, and they will consult the idols and the charmers, the mediums and the sorcerers. And the Egyptians I will give into the hand of a cruel master. A fierce king will rule over them, says the Lord of hosts. The waters will fail from the sea, and the river will be wasted and dried up. The rivers will turn foul, the brooks of defense will be emptied and dried up, the reeds and rushes will wither. The papyrus reeds by the river, by the mouth of the river, and everything sown by the river will wither, be driven away, and be no more. The fishermen will mourn, and all those who lament, who cast hooks into the river, and they will languish, who spread nets on the waters. Moreover, those who work in fine flax and those who weave fine fabric will be ashamed, and its foundations will be broken. All who make wages will be troubled of soul. Surely the princes of Zoan are fools. Pharaoh's wise counselors give foolish counsel. How do you say to Pharaoh, I am the son of the wise, the son of ancient kings? Where are they? Where is your wise man? Let them tell you now, and let them know that the Lord of hosts has purposed against Egypt. The princes of Zoan have become fools. The princes of Noph are deceived. They have also deluded Egypt, those who are the mainstay of its tribes. The Lord has mingled a perverse spirit in their midst and have caused Egypt to err in all her work as a drunken man staggers in his vomit. Neither shall there be any work for Egypt, which head or tail, palm brush, or bulrush may do. In that day Egypt will be like a woman and will be afraid and fear because of the waving of the hand of the Lord of hosts which he waves over it. And the land of Judah will be a terror to Egypt. Everyone who makes mention of it will be afraid in himself because of the counsel of the Lord of hosts which he has determined against it. Now I'm not going to read the rest of it. I'm going to jump down to verse... we'll just stop right there. So, you know, we covered all this when we did our Isaiah study a number of years ago. But what I want to look at here is some of the imagery. So we just heard a little while ago in chapter 6... And granted, this is many, many years later in Isaiah's life when he gives this prophecy, but what does he say? Behold, the Lord rides on a swift cloud. Keep that in mind when we hit Ezekiel chapter 1. He's going to come into Egypt, and the idols of Egypt will totter in his presence. The heart of Egypt will melt. He's going to cause civil war. It says Egyptians against Egyptians, city against city, kingdom against kingdom, everyone against his neighbor. They're going to consult the idols and the charmers and the mediums and the sorcerers, and they're not going to get any answer. I'm going to send a fierce king to rule over them. Then look in verse 5. The waters will fail from the sea, and the rivers will be wasted and dried up, and the river, excuse me, will be wasted and dried up. The rivers will turn foul, the brooks of defense will be emptied and dried up, the reeds and rushes will wither, the papyrus reeds by the river, by the mouth of the river, and everything sown by the river will wither, be driven away, and be no more. And then he talks about the fishermen are going to be mourning, and those who weave and work in flax and fabric will be mourning, and everyone who makes wages will be troubled. Now, when it talks about the river here, what's it talking about?
Nile.
Yeah.
And flood season. They depended on the flood season.
The river of Egypt, right? The river. In Egypt, you know, there was the river. I mean, it was the Nile. When we hear, I've told you before, when you hear the phrase the river in Scripture, almost always you're going to be talking about the river Euphrates, unless they happen to be talking about Egypt, in which case it will be the Nile, right? But that's what they're talking about. Now, God has determined that he is going to make a mess of Egypt, right? I mean, remember, the entire Egyptian economy, their entire survival depended on the Nile River. In particular, the floodwaters of the Nile River, because every year when the Nile River flooded, it brought down silt, right? Which then fertilized and watered the land, and then they grew their crops in them. What would happen? Let's just talk about the United States for a second. If I had to say the river in the United States, what would we say?
Mississippi.
Yeah, Mississippi. You know? The Mississippi. Huge river. What would happen if the Mississippi dried up? What would that mean for probably two-thirds of the U.S.?
Tragedy.
It'd be absolute tragedy, wouldn't it? What would it mean if the river dried up? What would cause the river to dry up?
No rain from Asheville to the Mississippi River.
On the other side too, right?
Yeah,
no rain from the Rockies to the Appalachians, pretty much, right?
Yeah, I'm talking about from the Continental Divide to the Mississippi.
And, yep, and all the way to the other Continental Divide, right?
Earthquake could also affect it.
It could. There are ways that you could imagine that a river would dry up. But I'm just talking about the level of disaster that would be, right? You can imagine. I mean, Earl, you got land up in those parts. You know how important the rain is up there to your fields, right?
Yes.
Up in Arkansas, you don't get rain. What does Arkansas look like?
Drought prone.
In fact, my mama grew up in northern Oklahoma, in the middle of the Depression. And what did they call it? What did they call Oklahoma up in when there wasn't any rain up there?
Dust Bowl.
The Dust Bowl. Right? The Dust Bowl. So, can you imagine being an Egyptian and even imagining what would happen if the Nile River was to dry up? Now, notice some things it says. It says, because this is another one of those uses of hyperbole in Scripture, and there's a lot of them in apocalyptic prophecy and dreams. Okay? Hyperbole, remember, is an over-exaggeration to make a point. Now, this does not mean, by me saying this is hyperbole, that there wasn't a couple of years when the Nile was just almost nothing. Right? Could have been major drought, right, for several years. We have situations in the Scripture where there were major droughts. In fact, remember Joseph's dream? Right? Pharaoh's dream. Joseph interprets Pharaoh's dream. And what did he say? You have 7 years of great plenty, and then you're going to have 7 years of terrible drought. How do we know it's a terrible drought? What about those wheat stalks he saw? They're all dried and withered up. What causes that drought? What about the cows, the hungry, skinny, scrawny cows that were so scrawny that when they ate the fat cows, they were still skinny and scrawny? What causes that? Major drought, right? So you can imagine, you can infer from that you know, there was 7 years of serious drought. Now, if there were 7 years of serious drought, what do you think happened to the Nile River? It probably was running low. You remember when we had the bad drought here a few years ago? You remember the rivers around here? They were really low. If you went to Charlotte and you looked at the lake there right as you're driving through Gastonia, man, it was so low that all the docks were sitting on mud, you know, the floating docks. They were sitting on mud, and the boats were, you know, no one could get to the water. Now, when he starts talking about all the reeds are dying, all the rushes are dying, everything growing by the side is dying, the plants are dying, if there's not enough water in the river to flow down the canals they made to irrigate their crops, what are going to happen to all that land? Nothing's going to grow. Right? So, one way or the other, first of all, yes, go ahead, Art.
Lower the, also, when there's not enough water, the fishes and stuff, they'll die because they'll deplete the oxygen in the water.
Yeah, and you find that too. One of in another place where God talks about this, he talks about all the fish will stink, right? Because they're going to die. They can't survive. Now, I don't want to spend a whole lot of time on this beyond what we've done. I want to say a couple of things. God decides to deliver a judgment on Egypt. And he does it by effectively destroying their economy. He destroys their source of food. And he destroys notice who's hurt. The people who work flax. What do you got to do to be able to work flax and make cloth?
And water.
Well, you got to have flax. And what's flax? Flax is a crop that you grow, right? If you don't have water, your flax is not going to be good enough. You're not going to have stuff to use. The fishermen. Why are the fishermen upset? Why can't they go fishing?
There's no fish.
There's no water. There's no fish, right? So here's a situation that God is telling them how he's going to visit judgment on them. He's going to destroy their economy by natural disasters. Now, if any of you have ever read, for instance, the book of Revelation, what do you see? You see a lot of there's these chapters in there where it says, and all the merchants of the earth and all their and they're all gonna mourn and wail. Why? Because their merchandise is no one buys their merchandise anymore. Their economy's been destroyed. You know, this is not an uncommon figure. Now let's go to 21. Now remember, this is still Isaiah. This is before, at this point when Isaiah is prophesying, the major world power in the area is Assyria. Assyria had swept down and taken away the northern kingdom of Israel. It tried to attack Jerusalem, but God drove them off. And Babylon is just starting to warm up. They haven't taken over yet. So here we go. Chapter 21, verse 1. The burden against the wilderness of the sea, as whirlwinds of the south pass through, so it comes from the desert, from a terrible land. A distressing vision is declared to me. The treacherous dealer deals treacherously, and the plunderer plunders. Go up, O Elam, besiege, O Media. All its signs I have made to cease. Therefore my loins are filled with pain. Pangs have taken a hold of me like pangs of a woman in labor. I was distressed when I heard it. I was dismayed when I saw it. My heart wavered. Fearfulness frightened me. The night for which I longed, he turned into me for fear. Now here comes what he saw. Prepare the table, set a watchman in the tower, eat and drink. Arise, you princes, anoint the shield. For the Lord has said to me, go set a watchman and let him declare what he sees. And he saw a chariot with a pair of horsemen, and a chariot of donkeys, and a chariot of camels. And he listened earnestly with great care. Then he cried, a lion, my lord. And I stand continually, he says, I stand continually on the watchtower in the daytime, and I have sat at my post every night, and look, here comes a chariot of men with a pair of horsemen. And he answered and said, Babylon is fallen, and all the carved images of her god he has broken down to the ground. Oh, my threshing and the grain of my floor, that which I have heard from the Lord of hosts, the God of Israel, I have declared to you. Now, the only thing I want to get out of this, and this is Isaiah again, this is before the kingdom of Babylon has even come really to major power. Assyria is the major power now. And yet, what is this prophecy foretelling? The fall of Babylon. Babylon hasn't even risen yet. And he's crying out, Babylon is fallen. Where do we hear that? We hear those exact words in the book of Revelation. Now he's talking about a different Babylon. But we hear those same words. When somebody in the first century who was acquainted with the book of Isaiah read that, what's the first thing that's going to come to his mind? I've heard this before. Right? So, just keep that in mind. These images and these words continually show up throughout the prophecies of the Bible, especially in these figurative, symbolic prophecies, all the way through. It's not just, whoops, there it is in the middle of Revelation, you know, chapter 18 or something. This is language that they understood. And if we're going to understand what some of that means, it helps us to really understand what some of this means. Now let's go to 34, Isaiah 34. So this is another very apocalyptic, not in the Greek sense of a revealing, but in the kind of modern English sense, meaning a disaster. Just read a little bit of this. Come near, you nations, to hear, and heed, you people. Let the earth hear, and all that is in it, the world and all things that come forth from it. For the indignation of the Lord is against all nations, and his fury against all their armies. He has utterly destroyed them. He has given them over to the slaughter. Also their slain shall be thrown out, their stench shall rise from their corpses, and the mountains shall be melted with their blood. All the host of heaven shall be dissolved, and the heavens shall be rolled up like a scroll, and all their hosts shall fall down, as a leaf falls from the vine, as a fruit falling from a fig tree. Boy, if I stopped right there, what do you think is being described? I mean, you've heard language like that before. What's being described? If you didn't read any more context, you would think, man, that sounds like the end of the world, doesn't it? The heavens are going to be rolled up. Their hosts, the stars, are going to fall like leaves. I'm against all nations. I'm going to utterly destroy them. There's going to be such death and destruction that the mountains are going to melt for the flow of blood over them, and the valleys are going to be filled with corpses. Sounds a lot like some of the language we hear in the book of Revelation. Right? But, read the context. Verse 5. For my sword shall be bathed in heaven, indeed it shall come down upon Edom, and on the people of my curse for judgment. The sword of the Lord is filled with blood, and is made overflowing with fatness, with the blood of lambs and goats, and the fat of kidneys of rams. For the Lord has a sacrifice in Bozra. Bozra's in modern day Iraq. And a great slaughter in the land of Edom. The wild oxen shall come down with them, and the young bulls and the mighty bulls. Their land shall be soaked with blood, and the dust saturated with fatness. For it is the day of the Lord's vengeance, the year of recompense for the cause of Zion. Its streams shall be turned into pitch, and its dust into brimstone. Its land shall become burning pitch. It shall not be quenched night or day. Its smoke shall ascend forever. Now, if I just read that verse to you, drop the context for a minute. Its stream shall be turned into pitch, and its dust into brimstone, and its land shall become burning pitch, and it shall not be quenched night or day, and its smoke shall ascend forever. Pitch is what?
Tar.
Yeah, tar. What's brimstone? Sulfur. Have you ever burned, what? You ever lit a match, the kind that you strike? You know what sulfur smells like, don't you? If you ever had chemistry classes, you burn sulfur. What's sulfur look like in its natural state? It's bright yellow powder, right? When you light sulfur, it turns black and then it produces a bright blue flame. And it stinks. And the reason it stinks is the sulfur is mixing with hydrogen and oxygen, and it's creating basically sulfuric acid. But in the air, it's a hydrogen sulfate, which is also what we call the smell of rotten eggs, which is sulfur. So this is what it's got. And what he's saying is the dust is going to turn into sulfur, the streams are full of tar, and it's all lit. And it's going to burn forever and ever and ever. What does that sound like? We took all the other context away. What does that sound like?
End of the earth.
Yeah. It sounds like the lake that burns with fire, right? I mean, it's very similar imagery. Not exactly the same words, but very similar imagery. And if you just read those verses, or if you took them out of context, you might try to apply it that way, but read the context. Look what it says in the very next verse. From generation to generation, it shall lie waste, and no one shall pass through it forever and ever. Well, hold on a second. If that was the end of the earth and complete destruction, why would you count it as generation to generation? There wouldn't be any generations to be a generation. And no one's going to walk through it. Well, hold on a second. If there's no one there, why would you say no one's going to walk through it? Keep reading. But the pelican and the porcupine shall possess it. Also the owl and the raven shall dwell in it. And he shall stretch out over it the line of confusion and the stones of emptiness. They shall call its nobles to the kingdom, but none shall be there, and all its princes shall be nothing. The thorns shall come up in its palaces, nettles and brambles in its fortresses. It shall be the habitation of jackals and a courtyard for ostriches. The wild beasts of the desert shall also meet with the jackals, and the wild goat will bleat to its companion, and also the night creature shall rest there and find herself a place of rest. The arrow snake shall make a nest and lay eggs and hatch and gather them under her shadow, and there shall be hawks shall be gathered. Every one will have her mate. Well, that sure doesn't sound like the end of the earth and lake that burns with fire, does it? So what do we have here? What kind of language do we have? This is hyperbole. Now, just like the Egyptians imagining what their world would be like without the Nile. Complete disaster, right? What about the Edomites imagining their world being nothing but sulfur and burning tar? It's a disaster. Now, is this a literal prophecy that everyone, that whole area, Iraq basically, is going to be burning with tar and sulfur forever? No. You know why? Because what's not going to live there if it's a land full of burning tar and sulfur?
Nothing.
did you see all these animals?
The
pelican, the porcupine, the owl, the raven, the jackal, the ostrich. Lots of wild beasts, wild goats, hawks.
They will reproduce. Verse 15.
They're sure not living in a lake burning with fire and brimstone, right? So, you see, one, context, context, context. Right? Especially in these very figurative, very symbolic verses. But let's keep that in mind, because we're going to see similar language like that later on. Now, we get to go to Ezekiel. Ezekiel chapter 1. We're going to spend a long time in Ezekiel, because there's a lot there. Ezekiel chapter 1. Now, the reason I went through all that, I want to just, you know, I'm trying to do this roughly chronologically. Ezekiel and Daniel didn't live until long after Isaiah was dead. Okay? But Isaiah was prophesying, you know, Egypt's doomed, Babylon has fallen, Edom's going to be turned into fire and brimstone. You know, we saw all that kind of stuff. Now, there's a trade-off in planning for this class as to whether we went to Daniel first or to Ezekiel first. And the reason for that is Ezekiel actually talks about Daniel. There's one place where Ezekiel says, you know, Jerusalem is so wicked that even if Daniel and Noah and, what was the other one? Lot, I think, were there, that they would save themselves if they couldn't save anyone else. So he talks about Daniel. He talks about Daniel as a well-known righteous man. So, you know, chronologically, and we know chronologically from the times, when was the first captivity? You're the expert
Daniel
on
Daniel was taken in 606.
Okay.
Ezekiel in 597.
Yeah.
And then the last invasion was in 586.
Okay. So the first invasion, Nebuchadnezzar comes down, conquers Jerusalem, doesn't destroy it, takes away the nobles and their princes, who were, including Daniel, Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego. Great Bible Bowl question, what are their Hebrew names? I never can remember them. But a good one to memorize. And then later, there was another round. It's about
597.
Well, I'm trying to do my backward BC math. What is that? 597 would be about 9 years, about 8 years. 7, something like that. Oh, you said 606. So it'd be 6 plus 597.
9 years.
9 years. Okay. Doing backwards math. So 9 years later, he comes back and he takes another batch of people. Ezekiel's in one of those. Now, one of the really neat things about the book of Ezekiel, there's lots of amazing things. This is, how many of you have ever read the whole book of Ezekiel? The whole thing. Up and down. About 5%. I'm not surprised. It is one of the wildest rides in Scripture. Okay? Because of the imagery, most of what he talks about here are visions. And when they're not visions, they're stuff that God has told Ezekiel to do, like take off all your clothes and lie down on your side for a year. And people go, well, that can't be real. That can't be. That's what it says. And then he says, get up, do it again on your other side for 40 days. And that, you know, we'll get to that. Build a model of the city of Jerusalem on a tile in the middle of the street. And lay siege to it. Because this is what's going to happen to Jerusalem. I mean, it's some really strange stuff. He says, get up in the middle of the night and pack up your stuff hurriedly like you're going into captivity and bind a blindfold around your eyes and grope for the wall and dig a hole through the wall and crawl through the wall like you're leaving for captivity. And all the people are looking at Ezekiel and going like, I mean, what would you think if somebody did that today?
You'd probably gone bonkers.
Yeah, you'd think they were crazy. This was Ezekiel's life, folks. You want to talk about somebody who people probably thought was crazy most of the time? Ezekiel's one of them. Ezekiel is also interesting in that it's very chronological. Look at the very first verse. Now it came to pass in the 30th year, in the fourth month, in the fifth day of the month, that I was among the captives by the river Kibar, that the heavens were open and I saw visions of God. On the fifth day of the month, which was in the fifth year of King Jehoiakim's captivity, the word of the Lord came expressly to Ezekiel. Now, he does this throughout the whole book. Now, he's got two chronologies he's telling us about. First of all, when he says, now it came to pass in the 30th year, the 30th year is Ezekiel's 30th year. He's 30 years old. Notice he says, in the fifth day of the month, which was the fifth year of King Jehoiakim's captivity. Now here's where you need to know your history. Who was king when Nebuchadnezzar came and grabbed them all and took them away? This was Jehoiakim. Right? In the fifth year of his captivity. This is, historians love this stuff. Because man, you can line it up and measure it out. You know exactly where it was. You also know something else. How old was Ezekiel when he was taken captive? He's now talking, it's his 30th year, and he says in the fifth year of Jehoiakim's captivity, it's when they got taken, he was 25 years old. Now how many of you, in your picture of Ezekiel in your mind, picture him as this grizzled old, you know, prophet, right? Well, he got to be an old man, at least quite a bit older, we don't know how old. But we do know what? He was a young man. What was the age at which a Hebrew man, a boy, was considered to be a full grown man, a full member of the community?
40.
It was definitely older than 25.
He's 35.
Yeah, I believe it's in the 30s, but one way or the other, in those.
No, I mean, what? In Ezekiel was 35.
Yeah.
Not 25.
Oh, he. Well, no, it says. He starts the vision, he says, this was the 30th year, my 30th year,
that's what I mean.
5 years into the captivity of King Jehoiakim. So he was taken when he was 25, he's now 30.
Oh, okay.
Okay. But you're going to hear this as we go through, he's going to say, and now on the 8th year, in the 5th month, this happened. And on the 9th year, on the 7th month, this happened. And on the 11th year, the 5th month, this happened. You're going to see this, it shows up in your chapter headings, so that's a lot of times where they broke the chapter markings, right? But what he does is he chronologically tells us what's going on. This was a young man. What does he say? Ezekiel the priest, the son of Buzi, in the land of the Chaldeans, he says where he's at. He's been taken captive. He's by the river Kibar, basically in Babylon. And he was a priest. If he was a priest, what tribe was he from? Levi. If he was 30 years old, would he have been a married man? Very likely. You know how we know he's a married man? Because in the middle of this book, after a bunch of prophecy, God comes to Ezekiel and he says, I'm going to take away from you the desire of your eye. And you're not to mourn. You're not to eat the bread of affliction. You're not to dress as men do for mourning. And he says, that day, I told the people what the Lord told me. And the next morning, my wife died. And I did as the Lord said. Ezekiel is a very powerful book. I think that's also one reason we don't read it. It's hard to read. Is God serious? He is most serious. Let's read this first chapter. Now it came to pass in the 30th year, in the 4th month, the 5th day of the month, that I was among the captives by the river Kibar, that the heavens were opened, and I saw visions of God. On the 5th day of the month, and which was the 5th year of King Jehoiakim's captivity, the word of the Lord came expressly to Ezekiel the priest, the son of Buzi, in the land of the Chaldeans by the river Kibar, and the hand of the Lord was upon him there. Then I looked, and behold, a whirlwind was coming out of the north, a great cloud with raging fire engulfing itself, and brightness was all around it, and radiating out of its midst, like the color of amber out of the midst of the fire. Also from within it came a likeness of 4 living creatures, and this was their appearance. They had the likeness of a man. Each one had 4 faces, and each one had 4 wings. Their legs were straight, and the soles of their feet were like the soles of calves' feet. They sparkled like the color of burnished bronze. The hands of a man were under their wings on their 4 sides, and each of the 4 had faces and wings. Their wings touched one another. The creatures did not turn when they went, but each one went straight forward. As for the likeness of their faces, each had the face of a man. Each of the 4 had the face of a lion on the right side, and each of the 4 had the face of an ox on the left side, and each of the 4 had the face of an eagle. These were their faces. Their wings stretched upward, 2 wings of each one touched another, and 2 covered their bodies. And each one went straight forward. They went wherever the Spirit wanted to go, and they did not turn as they went. As for the likeness of the living creatures, their appearance was like burning coals of fire, like the appearance of torches going back and forth among the living creatures. The fire was bright, and out of the fire went lightning. And the living creatures ran back and forth in appearance like a flash of lightning. Now as I looked at the living creatures, behold, a wheel was on the earth beside each of the living creatures with its 4 faces. The appearance of the wheels and their workings was like the color of beryl, and all 4 had the same likeness. The appearance of their workings was, as it were, a wheel in the middle of a wheel. When they moved, they went toward any one of 4 directions. They did not turn aside as they went. As for their rims, they were so high they were awesome, and their rims were full of eyes, all around the 4 of them. And when the living creatures went, the wheels went beside them. And when the living creatures were lifted up from the earth, the wheels were lifted up. Wherever the Spirit wanted to go, they went, because there the Spirit went. And the wheels were lifted up with them, for the Spirit of the living creatures was in the wheels. When those went, these went. And when those stood, these stood. And when those were lifted up from the earth, the wheels were lifted up together with them, for the Spirit of the living creatures was in the wheels. The likeness of the firmament above the heads of the living creatures was like the color of an awesome crystal stretched out over their heads. And under the firmament, their wings spread out straight, one towards another. Each one had 2 which covered one side, and each one had 2 which covered the other side of the body. When they went, I heard the noise of their wings, like the noise of many waters, like the voice of the Almighty, a tumult, like the noise of an army. And when they stood still, they let down their wings. And a voice came from above the firmament that was over their heads. Whenever they stood, they let down their wings. And above the firmament over their heads was the likeness of a throne, an appearance of it like a sapphire stone. And on the likeness of the throne was a likeness of the appearance of a man high above it. Also from the appearance of his waist and upward I saw, as it were, the color of amber, and of the appearance of fire all around within it. And from the appearance of his waist and downward I saw, as it were, the appearance of fire and brightness all around. Like the appearance of a rainbow in a cloud on a rainy day, so was the appearance of the brightness all around it. This was the appearance of the likeness of the glory of the Lord. So when I saw it, I fell on my face, and I heard the voice of one speaking. Now, it doesn't stop there. The chapter stops there, but I'm going to stop there for a minute. I don't know how many times I've read and studied this over the last year, but it still just overwhelms me thinking about it. Pretty awesome display, isn't it? What do we see that's similar to what Isaiah saw? Now, Isaiah saw something a little different. Remember what Isaiah saw? Let's go back to chapter 6 for a second. Isaiah chapter 6. So he says, in the year the king Uzziah died, I saw the Lord sitting on a throne, high and lifted up. So we had, again, we have a throne, the Lord sitting on it. Cherubim's robe filled the temple. Above it stood seraphim. Each one had six wings. With two he covered his face, with two he covered his feet, and with two he flew. These are sound like different critters, right? One cried to the other and said, holy, holy, holy is the Lord of hosts. The whole earth is full of his glory. And the posts of the door were shaken by the voice of him who cried out. Remember that whole thing about when they spoke, it was like the rushing of waters, the noise of an army. And the house was filled with smoke. So what are we seeing here? We've got a very, you know, first I started drawing it. First he says, I see a whirlwind. I see a whirlwind with fire being licked into it and turning on itself. And I see the shining of like amber shining out of it. And out of that, I see living creatures. All of a sudden, I've got living creatures here. I'm not even going to try to draw. Too many wings to draw. I see living creatures. And he describes the living creatures. How does he describe the living creatures? What's unusual about them?
Everything.
They got wings.
They got four sides.
Yeah, and they've got four faces.
Four faces. One face like a man, one like an ox, and so forth.
Which one's on which side? I'm going to try to get this right.
They always went forward.
The lion's on the right side. So here's the lion.
I'm just going to write lion. Eagle or something.
The ox is on this side. The man's in the middle. And probably in the back is the eagle, but it doesn't say exactly. It just says it had four sides. So there's the head. That's strange enough. Now he's got a body, and he's got four wings. Now this is not supposed to look like a bug, okay? And every wing had hands under the wings. And then he's got legs. What did he say his feet were like? It said the soles of his feet were like calves' feet. Now I wondered about that, because it doesn't say his feet were like calves' feet. It says the soles of his feet were like calves' feet. So I don't know if that means it had, you know, human-like feet with hoof-like things under them, or if it was calves-like feet. I'm not exactly sure. What about their color? What were these like to look at? What does it say?
Bright colors.
Sparkling. Like the color of burnished bronze. Do you remember? Now these are called living creatures, and they're called cherubim in other places. You remember when we talked about seraphs? So I got it spelled right. Seraphs in Isaiah 6. That word means fiery or copper colored. And I told you that a lot of times you're going to see the notion of bright, molten metal, especially copper or bronze, being talked about. Here you have an example. They sparkled like burnished bronze. What does it mean to burnish a metal?
Rub it?
Yeah, you rub it. Exactly. And why do you rub it? What does it do when you rub it?
It shines.
Makes it shine. Exactly right. So this is like polished bronze. And what else is going on? Let's see. Lots of discussion about how they look and which way they go. Here we go. Verse 13. The likeness of the living creatures, their appearance was like burning coals of fire. Again, more of that bright, orangey, yellowy kind of color. And like the appearance of torches going back and forth among the living creatures. The fire was bright, and out of the fire went lightning. And the living creatures ran back and forth in appearance like a flash of lightning. So what do we have here? We got these creatures doing what? Are they sitting still?
No, they're moving fast.
They're moving fast, too. And there's light and lightning and everything flashing all around them. And what else? What does he keep saying about, and when they move, they don't turn when they move?
They don't look back.
They go forward.
Well, that's interesting. What's forward? They have four faces.
I guess it's always, this one goes this way. Never go backwards.
It's an interesting thought. It doesn't explain this directly, but if you think about, you know, okay, they got four faces on their head. It doesn't say they have four heads. They have one head with four faces. So more than likely, he's talking to humans, right? He's talking to humans that understand heads and faces. Probably we're talking about, you know, face on each side. He says when they move, they don't turn. So the man's face doesn't do like this. What do they do when they move? They go this way, they go this way, they go this way. But one face is always going forward, right? It's interesting. Strange. And what are they doing with their wings? Now here it talks about four wings. Remember it says with two of them they cover their body and with two of them they fly. So they're sitting there with their wings, you know, like this or something, right? With two of them. And two of them are flying. And what does it say they flap when they fly? Now what does it say? The wings stay straight. This is very strange. You ever seen a critter that flies like that?
A hummingbird.
Hummingbirds look that way, don't they? They're actually moving their wings back and forth, but they're doing it very, very fast, and they do it horizontally. They don't do it up and down.
They move so fast you can't really tell their wings are moving.
Yeah. What about these wheel things? Verse 15. And as I looked at the living creatures, behold, the wheel was on the earth beside each living creature with its four faces. So how many wheels were there? Well, there were four creatures, and each one had a wheel beside it. There were four wheels. The appearance of the wheels and their workings was like the color of beryl. What is beryl? This is the spelling of it. Any rock hounds in here? It's a family. It's the same as the emerald family. An emerald is actually a beryl. Beryl is a general classification for a whole series of semi-precious stones. Barrels come in all kinds of deep greens. There are some yellow barrels, but green is a likely color for them. If you go to the Natural History Museum in D.C., you'll see barrel crystals that are like this big, and they're just glorious looking. Lots and lots and lots of descriptions we're going to see in these visions. Talk a lot about fire, a lot about jewels. I wonder why that is. I don't have an answer. This is just a question. It's interesting, isn't it?
Look at verse 17. You were talking about what direction they go in.
Yes.
But in verse 17, it sounds like that if it wanted to go, it wants to go to, I don't even know how to say it, but it looks like whatever the direction the head wants to go, they go in that direction. So it could go in four directions.
Right. When they moved, they went toward any one of four directions. They did not turn aside as they went. That would kind of mean sort of like that whatever one face wanted to go in that direction, the whole body moved, and it moved like this. It didn't turn and go. Right, it moved in four directions.
It said straight.
Yeah.
Earlier.
Why is that? The answer? Deuteronomy 29:29. You're gonna know this verse by the time we're done. Deuteronomy 29:29, what does it say? The secret things belong to God. In other words, we don't know. We don't know. It is very tempting when we're looking at these kinds of images. I've got to finish up here. To speculate how we would do it. When we talk about this, it talks about a wheel within a wheel. So some people sit there and say, well, that's kind of like, you know, two wheels, sort of like if you've ever seen, what's it called?
Gyroscope.
Which would actually make some sense in that they go straight. And have you ever played with a gyroscope, try to move it around?
Yeah.
Right? But we don't know. It says it's full of eyes. Are those human eyes? You know, some of the people who like to get into trying to find signs of UFOs, the Bible go, ooh, those are lights, like on the side of those flying saucer. You know. Speculation is speculation. Let's remember that as we go forward. We'll stop here because we're out of time, but we are into it now. There'll be a lot of interesting things to learn. Thank you.